if there's no legislation that says a partnership intermediary can't do something, then we're doing it. We don't let anything stop us. We just continue to push the boundaries. And I think that's really important in the innovation space, is continue to test the fences.
Ackerschnacker, der Podcast des Cyber Innovation Hub der Bundeswehr.
Welcome to the 12th episode of the Ackerschnacker, and this time is the second episode of our summer tour, in which we talk to partners from international defense innovation units. And after having spoken to the United States Air Force Innovation Unit 2 weeks ago, today we want to talk to the Special Operations Forces Innovation Unit, SoftWorks. And with that, I welcome my guest, Tamarin Bates, who is the director of SoftWorks and has been working for them for the past 5 years, right from the start on. And for the next 30 minutes, he'll be open for our questions.
Hey, good morning. How's everybody doing?
We're fine here. So we have it like 4 p.m. in the afternoon on Thursday. So regularly in the Navy, I don't know if that's international or just the German Navy, that's actually time for everyone to sit down and gather and eat cake. But since it's breakfast time with you guys, I think we'll just skip that here. We have 30 minutes to talk about SoftWorks, which is the innovation unit for the Special Operations Forces of the United States. And therefore, of course, a very, very highly interesting, mysterious innovation unit, I would say. And I hope, even though you're kind of disguised there in the shade, you can bring a little more light into what SoftWorks is doing, what the mission is, and how exactly you work, and what projects you're currently on. First of all, because from what I like reverse engineered, you have been existing for about 5 years now, is that correct?
So September will be our birthday, our 5 years.
What led to the foundation of SoftWorks? Why was it the Special Operations Forces first to say, okay, we need an innovation unit? Like, what pain points actually led people saying, okay, let's build something like a garage in an old tattoo shop somewhere in the middle of Tampa and do things different?
Well, it's kind of a twofold story, right? So there's one part that's about the technology and innovation itself. And I think we warfighters need to maintain their ability to be on the cutting edge of technology, because that's certainly what our adversaries are doing. The part was that, particularly in the United States, the government actually held most of the breadth and scope through their labs of all the innovation that was going on across the nation. And then you saw a start to change in the 80s and the 90s, where the commercial industry was actually starting to outstrip government labs as far as innovation was concerned. And so when you push that into the 2000s, and then you look at the actual budgets of the Department of Defense, when compared across industry, I mean, it was phenomenal. You're talking trillions of dollars in the commercial space centered around innovation that the government was having a very hard time attracting and actually assimilating. And so that was the original goal of SoftWorks, which is the goal today, is to tap into those non-traditional markets and non-traditional technologies and actually get those into the hands of the warfighter in an accelerated fashion.
But how do you do this in comparison to the standard linear acquisition process that have been there before, as you just described them, who started to get a little like behind the actual R&D that is happening in the commercial sector? So like, where do you align in parallel to them, or maybe on top? How does it work?
So we're actually kind of tangential, or to some degree parallel, in the sense of we're not trying to force the tech. We're just observing the technology that is already occurring and then kind of grabbing best of breed and bringing that in to the SOCOM enterprise, making them aware, harnessing it, if you will. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. So if we go a little more into detail into all this. So on the one hand, how close do you work with SOCOM, which is, you know, like 5 miles away from where you are? How closely do you work with the operators to get to know about the pain points? Where do you get the input for your ideas and your projects from?
The way that it works day to day, I think, is pretty fundamental. It's kind of our bread and butter and what we do. And in part of what you talked about, so we'll receive a nomination from anyone in the enterprise and at US SOCOM, whether it be an individual warfighter, one of the components, be it AFSOC, depending on its maturity, et cetera, et cetera. We kind of sit down with everybody involved, all the stakeholders, and we determine thing acquisition strategy, because associated with it, then it's probably not ready or doesn't have a high enough priority. And then subsequently, we also want to make sure, are we curing the symptom or disease? Because we're we're big at getting after the root of the problem. And then what does success look like both short term and long term? Because a lot of times we work on everything from, you know, somebody's written something on a cocktail napkin all the way up to, you know, a 78 page document that says this is our requirement.
Yeah.
So depending on that, we'll determine what types of activities or mechanisms need to be applied. And then what we subsequently do after that is we put it out to our ecosystem. We have about 40,000 partners in our ecosystem. And then we also do, along with that ecosystem announcement, we'll actually do a lot of targeted marketing market research ourselves. And then we kind of drive a submission process. So everybody will against that problem. And then the government, once we get all those submissions, the government will actually down select and will bring in those potential offers and conduct, we facilitate discussions. And from there, it could move on to a contract or something is still kind of immature, but it's a great idea. Then actually SoftWorks will form a business agreement with that company and then mature it.
What you've mentioned somewhere along the line is your ecosystem, saying you have around 40,000 peers in that ecosystem. What does that ecosystem consist of? Like, what does it look like? What different entities do we have there? Is it academia, industry, a mix? Above all, how did you manage to build it up?
I don't have the exact percentages in front of me, but I would say that roughly 50% of our ecosystem is actually commercial or industry based. People that care about SOCOM challenges and see business opportunities in it. Then we've got a certain percentage, about 25%, that are government, right? Other government organizations such as Department of Homeland Security. We've got obviously SOCOM involved, some of their components, sisters of that 25% makeup. And then the other 25% is from labs and academics as well, just roughly. And then, you know, for us, I think how we did it was really one single thing. We've got some very talented groups that are community marketing stuff. And that's important for any business in today's day and age. But I think also what we did that secured it, right? It's one thing to surge in numbers, but you've got to retain system size as well. And part of what we do to retain clients in that ecosystem is to make sure that we're very transparent and that we don't use the ecosystem or abuse it or use it incorrectly. Yeah. So we make sure that every time we send something out on our ecosystem, it is for no other purpose than a business opportunity for everybody that's involved in the ecosystem.
The business that you interact with, when you say, okay, well, they do always look at the business opportunity since you're transparent on this, but they are still aware that this is an innovation process, right? Which can lead to something, not as necessarily need to lead to something, right? Because this is something that we also discover. Of course, companies approach us because they see an entry point into a broad armed forces deployment of their equipment. Or we say, okay, well, we of course look at it, but we can't, you know, promise to just bring it all in the line because we are just assessing actually what this technology in general brings us and not. How is the expectation management working with that with you guys?
That is a struggle. I think it's a struggle for everyone. It's not just limited to the Department of Defense. If you look at particularly like transformational or disruptive levels of technology, it's tough for anybody to subsume, right, and take on. So we actually have kind of two parallel efforts that have really helped us out that delineate those two problem sets. So one is when I talked about the ecosystem before, what's very helpful there is we don't announce anything on the ecosystem unless there's a business opportunity, right? There's a legitimate need that SOCOM has voiced. They've prioritized it and they said, hey, there's funding associated with this. We are going to go after this if we find something of value. That's a specific demand signal that we send out to our ecosystem. The other thing that we do, we just started it. It hasn't been going on that long, but for several months now, we've actually started a thing called Tech Tuesday. And the idea was, because it's so hard to get transformational technology in front of government stakeholders, we developed a mechanism where every Tuesday we bring in transformational companies or technologies or capabilities, and we put them in front of a very broad audience of government users. It's not just SOCOM, although they're our main focus. It's anybody in the government that wants to participate. They're able to dial in and hear the pitches, and it's non-obligational. Right. Meaning you just get to come on virtually, make your pitch. share some slides, talk about the capability, answer some questions, and then the government stakeholder that's interested can potentially follow up online with them afterwards. So that's really been a very powerful venue for us because it really helps still create an entry point for our government partners, but it's a kind of non-obligatory, right? Nobody's required to do anything. It's just a potential opportunity.
Like the methods that you're having, you also do a lot of hackathons, for example, or price challenges. What are your experiences with all this? Is this actually like leading to the results that you're aiming for before you start a challenge, for example? Because I mean, they are sort of open in their results, right?
Right.
So like after 5 years of conducting them, what are your experiences on this?
This is going to sound kind of harsh, but I tell everybody, don't do a hackathon. They're a complete waste of time. That's just been my experience. The challenge with it is that there are some rare instances when if you're doing a very traditional hackathon where, you know, it's ones and zeros, it's all digital and you're developing an algorithm. There are instances where we've been successful with that and it's actually transitioned. But there's a tendency by everybody to say, oh, well, if it works in the digital domain, then it works for everything. And they try to do hackathons with actual hardware. And those are just a complete, we won't do them. I think prize challenges work pretty well. We've had some pretty good success with them, but they're just one notch better than a hackathon. What really is very effective for us is our collaboration events and then subsequent to that assessment events. That's really the majority of the types of events that we do. Yeah. And we've had a great deal of success for them. I call them our bread and butter events. I think those actually produce the most promising and lasting results.
Okay. Taking a step back, what is working with the special operation community different from, let's say, FWorks, who we talked to like 2 weeks ago, who work with the whole Air Force? Like, are there differences in the mindset? Is, you know, there a reason why SOF started first having this innovation unit? And why maybe is it a little easier or maybe even a little more trickier than do innovation for that very, very particular kind of troops? And from what I've sliced on the internet, you've been in service for them for like roughly 2 decades as well, right?
Right, right. It's a good question. And I think there's a lot to unpack there, but I think it really comes down to two different mindsets. And it's the way that we're task organized as well. So if you look at AFWorks, and I have a lot of friends up at AFWorks, great organization, but it's actually driven by the service, right? Like corporate Air Force owns AFWorks.
Yeah.
What's a little more distinctive about SOFWorks is we're actually a 501c3. So we're not government. That distinction is important because it allows us a freedom of maneuver that maybe they won't have in some instances. When it comes to the actual customer sets, what's interesting about working for US SOCOM, you know, their willingness to take risk, it's paramount. It's a hallmark of who SOCOM is.
Yeah.
So they're willing to take some risks where others might be a little more reserved. And so that's why they're a great, great client to work with. The other thing that SOCOM has an advantage on in the innovation space is they will routinely field and utilize what we call the 80% solution.
Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be good enough. And so a lot of times that's a really big advantage in the innovation space is their willingness to take low rate item of production or, you know, just a minimum viable product and actually go test it and get it out in the field a lot faster. So those are some distinct differences and then also advantages that SOCOM has. I think the last thing I would say about SOCOM is SOCOM doesn't have, they're a great partner and they don't have, there's kind of a misnomer that they have some special authorities and they don't. SOCOM does not have any special acquisition authorities. They just choose to exercise what authorities there are already in place. They have a tendency to look at them and say, well, if it doesn't say that I can't do something, then I can. And so that helps expedite that process as well. It's just kind of our client's mindset about how to get after stuff. And so subsequently, culturally, because of my background, I kind of bring that into the SOFWorks platform as well. And so our team has the same mindset from an operational perspective, right? A day-to-day, if there's no legislation that says a partnership intermediary can't do something, then we're doing it. We don't let anything stop us. We just continue to push the boundaries. And I think that's really important in the innovation space is continue to test the fences.
It is certainly. Also, of course, since you are working quite closely with a public authority, we actually are still kind of a public authority. We are, of course, bound to some bureaucracy in one way. right? But also what you said is the key factor here is to look if something is explicitly forbidden, and if not, well, it's not forbidden. And also before we went live, you said something like, okay, we take legal counsel as it is, right? And right. At the end, it's still about leadership.
That's a fair point. And I think that's another differentiator potentially with SOCOM is the tight-knit leadership and their tendency to look at legal counsel as simply what it is. It's counsel. It's often very sage. You should always listen to it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to a leadership decision as to whether you should do something or not, because they're the ones that have the authority and the responsibility. And so oftentimes when in legislation or when you're talking about authorities, there's oftentimes where it's a gray area where it doesn't say specifically yes or no. And so subsequently it's subject to interpretation. And so that's where, you know, an operational commander or a Mr. Smith at the acquisition executive level or the commander of USOCOM would look at something and say, well, we need to be able to do this. And it doesn't, you know, specifically prohibit us from doing it. Yeah. So we've heard everyone's counsel and this is the decision that we're making based on that and then just go with it.
Is that because I read in the background on your like mission banner there that one of your mission is to bring together divergent thought. So is that also part of your mission to sort of promote that kind of leadership style and working together? Or is that already inherent in the SOCOM community?
It's tough. I think if we were very honest about it, I think that divergent thought is different and difficult for everyone. You know, the old adage, you know, I often tell people that I've served for some great leaders and bar none, every leadership book tells you to surround yourself with different opinions. But it really comes down to that leadership point of, did you actually listen to the different opinions? You know, you don't surround yourself with yes men is the big thing, but we'll be under the person that says no. So I think divergent thought is certainly something that we're always trying to attract. And I kind of think of it in terms of part of our mission is day to day is to help really create innovative capabilities for the warfighter by, you know, bringing in non-traditional methods or new novel or provocative methods and techniques. And so a lot of that requires divergent thought. So we always are, you know, part of our inclusionary note is that we bring in all of those divergent thinkers to kind of really challenge our assessments and assumptions, because we all have a tendency to live in our own little silos. And so I think bringing in those outside agitators is imperative to really address, are you addressing the problem? Do you really understand the problem? And are there cheaper solutions to that problem set? You know, not everything has to be $1 million program. A lot of times things can be solved with very low dollar commercial applications as well.
But you also do some rapid prototyping within your team, right?
Correct. So there's a couple of ways that we do the rapid prototypes. A lot of the rapid prototyping that we do is kind of by with and through others, meaning, you know, I kind of explained how that process works for us. And then at the end of that, if the government still wants us to do a business-to-business agreement to mature a technology, then, you know, obviously we'll do that agreement and then we oversee the program, which is still a rapid prototype, right? We're trying to get something from a very immature TRL 4-5 up to potentially a 7. So that's kind of the working by with and through others. And then there's another subset where we're actually physically doing the prototyping here in our own team, meaning our guys are actually the ones doing it. There is a portion of that, I'd probably say somewhere around 15-20% we're actually doing in-house.
Because you said along also that what's special maybe also about the SOCOM community is that they actually take 80% solutions and work with them right away. How easy is it for you to implement innovation techniques or little devices or like projects that you're working on roughly in general? How easy is it to implement them into the daily operational work?
Great question. And it is one of the, you know, we call that the valley of death. You know, from a company's perspective, their valley of death is they've got an MVP and they can't get it to market. Yeah. For us in the innovation space on behalf of the government, the valley of death is, hey, we've built it and now you need to be able to ingest it. So when I talked earlier about how it works, it wasn't always that way. When we first started, there was a lot of rage against the machine. You know, it was very difficult for SOCOM to subsume acquisitionally, you know, a lot of the capabilities that we were developing. And so through a lot of business processes and, you know, fly, fix, fly models, we actually have a very good, robust model that now, you know, SOCOM only brings us the things that are imperative to them, again, to kind of have that prioritization. And the acquisition professionals are part of that whole process. When something comes out on the back end, they subsume it immediately, either under another transactional authority or, you know, FAR-based contracting and get it into the warfighter's hands much faster. So there's a lot of bumps and bruises, a lot of scar tissue, if you will.
Yeah, but because we do have the same experiences here, like the same sort of valley of death. And of course, like all sides actually try to narrow it down, maybe one side more than the other one. What I subsume from your answer is that it was a learning process also over there with you guys, right?
Yeah, it definitely was. I think the key for us was really establishing the business rules, or what I call the business rules. I mean, it's a 10-page document. It has nothing to do with our formal agreement. Yeah. It's really the day-to-day business rules and the touch points that we have with our government counterparts that really solidified the process. That was born out of that spirit of contention. Everybody wanted the same thing. We all want to accelerate kit and capability into the hands of the warfighter. So we're not diametrically opposed in that aspect. It was just, what's the best way to do that? And so those business rules really helped us get to that next level.
Your staff in general, you said it's around 25 people. Was that correct?
22. Yeah.
Okay. So how many of them actually do have the expertise from having had service within the special operation forces or maybe like affiliates before? And like, how necessary would you say this knowledge is to actually conduct all these projects?
You know, it's kind of interesting. It's just my leadership philosophy. There's only two of us that have prior SOF experience, myself and then our deputy, Tony Petgel. He served 35 years as a Green Beret and actually retired as the Sergeant Major for J3 at the SOCOM headquarters. So, you know, of course, we're very sheep dipped in everything SOCOM, but that's it. And so intentionally, when I set it up, I wanted, again, kind of back to that divergent thought, I wanted to be surrounded by people who challenged my assumptions about what SOF needed or how best to procure it. I think that's really, quite candidly, been one of the keys to our success. Yeah. Plus, the other thing is if I'm surrounding myself with enablers that are going to help SOCOM, it also allows my team to say, hey, we're not the experts on what's needed operationally. Right. I gave up my right to vote, you know, several years ago. Yeah. And so then that enforces or forces my team to make sure that they have the stakeholder in the room, that they're actually talking to the operational elements and or their representatives and getting feedback from them directly and not just listening, you know, to me and my thoughts on it. So I think that's been extremely important to diversify in that way. And then I would also say what's helped us just internally as a team is it's a business. So we've got office and business management functions, events, comms, and marketing functions. So we also don't have a team of 30 engineers because, quite frankly, everything from submarines to satellites is what we work on. No single group, particularly with only 22 people, can possibly have the expertise. And so really what I've surrounded myself with are stress reducers and problem solvers. Because that's really all you need is the guys that can quickly figure out what needs to occur and then make it happen.
So, well, 30 minutes are almost over or roughly over. So I come to my last question, which is from the past 5 years, what is or has been your favorite project you've been conducting?
It's one that we've just actually started recently, and that's kind of a loaded question because there's a lot of them that are my favorites. We've had a lot of fun.
You can name several, right? It's not just one.
Yeah, we've actually had a pretty good run of some fun projects that I'm personally passionate about. But I think the biggest one is the one that we're really undertaking right now, and it's what we call Project Replay. And it's actually remotely piloting legacy aircraft. You know, ISR is a very important mission set. Not just for SOF, but for, you know, everyone across the spectrum, right? Especially even for your folks. It's very expensive. but we're reliant on it and we have to have it. So we're actually taking a legacy aircraft, one that you could find on a ramp now, nothing special about it, and remotely piloting it, and quite frankly, putting autonomous hooks in it so that in the future, when society and the Department of Defense is ready for autonomy, we'll be that much further ahead and ready to go. And the real purpose of it was to really make it more affordable. You know, ISR is very, very expensive, and a lot of it is because we buy, you know, Snowflake platforms, or we're just kind of held captive by one industry partner that's kind of cornered the market. And so our goal was to just be able to go out and take any kind of legacy aircraft and with a little bit of work, remotely pilot it or autonomous capability. So that was the one that's kind of the most fun for me.
Yeah, that sounds definitely like something that, you know, could be applicable for every forces around the world. Because, I mean, yeah, as you just said, we all have sort of the same limited capacities on ISR, but still have legacy systems standing around. So that's an interesting approach to fix this. What would be the further steps in that project, for example? Do you have a challenge planned to get solutions in, or do you already have solutions that you're following?
Yeah, we already have solutions. We're building it. So we've completed most of the feasibility studies. We've done some of the initial assessments. And so now we're just doing the software modeling on it to make sure that the software systems, you know, are going to be effective. We have a high degree of confidence they will be. We're working with folks that were in the automobile autonomy industry that already have demonstrated the capability. I think our biggest hurdle is really dual engines. So we'll be tackling that in December. But I'm pretty confident that it's not going to be a failure. We're going to learn a lot from it. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, certainly sounds exciting. Okay, perfect. Tamrin, so much for your time. I do have a couple of more questions on my list, but we've exceeded our 30 minutes already. People are always very curious over here about your work, because as I said, you've been one of the first innovation units in the defense context, and certainly one that sort of made the first move in many, many domains, and therefore have a lot of expertise on things where we still try to find our way as well, maybe in methods, maybe in tools, maybe in clusters of topics that we set for our projects. So it's definitely a lot of things for us to learn and copycat here and there also to not run into the same mistakes, if you allow so. But thanks already for sharing all these insights with me today and with our listeners.
What a great opportunity for us. We thank you for thinking of us. It's always good to reach out, particularly internationally. We do some international stuff, so your folks on your side of the pond can certainly join our ecosystem and participate in the challenges. We look forward to having them join up.
Okay, perfect. So all the best to you there, and have a very nice remaining Thursday. And to our viewers and listeners, thanks so much for joining today for this half hour of our summer tour. Bye.
All right. Thank you.
Das war der Ackerschnacker. Abonnieren auf ackerschnacker.info.